TAP hearings here, just for the sake of saving some House bills here. And so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3154, and I close the public hearing on 3154. I open a public hearing on House Bill 3233, and I close the public hearing on House Bill 3233. And opening a public hearing on House Bill 3407, and closing the public hearing on House Bill 3407. I expect most of the Democrats in just a bit. They're caucusing, and we'll have the rest of our other members coming along soon, I trust. In the meantime, we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 3154, and I'll have our committee 3145, excuse me, and I will have our committee administrator explain that to us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, at that end of the desk. This would allow a manufacturer or wholesaler of wine or malt beverages to extend credit to a package store licensee. And the grocers are here to, President Cruz can't come because he's in committee, so yes, please, McCoy, to introduce the bill.
All right, thank you. Mr. McCoy, please.
Like one of our friends.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve McCoy, here representing the Oregon Grocery Industry Association. Come before you here with for House Bill 3145, which has been indicated would allow the extension of credit for purchases of beer and wine by the distributors of those beverages. This bill was heard and this is the outcome of a 1997 session. This bill passed out of committee. We have done nothing to change it. This would be for package stores only, which are basically food stores, people that have a license to retail beer and wine unopened in packages. If you go through this real quickly, the bill simply says that credit may be extended. It doesn't mandate that credit would be extended. If they do so, manufacturers and wholesalers who elect to extend credit under this section must establish reasonable criteria and apply that criteria on an equal basis to all the package store licensees in their marketing area. The credit will be extended for a period of 15 days. There's also a section in here that's called for injunctive relief may be brought in circuit court by any manufacturer, wholesaler, package store licensee if they have reason to believe that there is some other manufacturer, wholesaler, or package store licensee who is breaking this law and receiving credit that goes beyond the 15-day limit. We did that for one reason, really, and that was because the OLCC had expressed concerns that that unless something like this was put in the bill, it would require them to be expending added manpower and funds to enforce this bill. So, in lieu of that, we put that section in. That section, therefore, basically, the only way the OLCC comes into this is if the court issues an injunction and an action under the provisions of the section. The court will notify the OLCC, who will then have the ability under their enforcement powers to cancel, suspend, or impose some other penalty on the offending parties. Fairly simple bill. Basically, the reason we want this is something that was enacted as we came out of prohibition in the early 30s. There were reasons for that at that time. Basically, the legislature at that point was concerned because of the way retailing was set up at that point and coming out of prohibition that they didn't have brewers or the manufacturers of alcohol getting a sort of vertical monopoly involved in the manufacturing, distribution, and sale of the product. To do that, they set up strict walls between manufacturers, distributors, and retailers. Included in that with the express purpose basically of making sure that none of the three entities could get a financial control and therefore control the complete distribution of alcohol to the citizens of the country. Also back in the 30s, if you recall, supermarket industries, we know it really didn't exist. You had really a series of little small neighborhood stores where literally at that point customers still came in with their list and it was selected for them and given to them. It wasn't even self-serve at that point in time. So at that point, there might have been a reason to prohibit the extension of credit, basically, again, with the concern that with these small stores, they could get on the hook with a great amount of credit, and then somehow the manufacturer distributor could control, to a degree, their marketing of the alcoholic beverages. Not the case today. And in fact, really today, 66 years later, if anything, it's the other way around. Now the manufacturers and distributors go hat in hand to the retailers, hoping that they can get their product onto the retailer shelves. The retailers control those shelves, and they decide what is going to be marketed, where it's going to be marketed, and how it's going to be marketed. There's no way that I can think of that any manufacturer or wholesaler could in any way control or affect the way any retailer markets or markets their product to the customer. In essence, this is really a business issue. It's not an alcohol control issue. The consumption of alcohol will not increase if credit is allowed to be extended on beer and wine sales. This issue only deals with the purchase and payment of product sales, which already occur under the current system at the same volumes. Typical supermarket today stocks between 40 and 50,000 items, and beer and wine are the only products they cannot buy on credit, the only products we cannot buy on credit. Again, this bill allows the extension of credit by the distributor during the sale of beer or wine. We emphasize the word allows because it's not our intention to take away the distributor's ability to refuse credit to a poor credit risk or withdraw credit if a customer is not paying in a timely manner. This just allows the extension of credit. And frankly, given the fact that the distributors in Oregon, again, the state has afforded them a monopoly on their marketing areas. In other words, if you're a retailer in Marion County, for example, and you want to buy Miller beer, you're going to buy it from Thomas Distributing based here in Salem, and that's it. You can't buy it anywhere else from any other distributor. They've already got a monopoly granted. So it's not a threat if their ability to give credit the prohibition on credit is taken away. It's not going to be a threat to those distributors because they've got a monopoly. There's nowhere else we can go to purchase beer and wine. And if they choose not to, under this bill, extend credit, we still have nowhere else to go. We're going to have to deal with them and again, not receive credit. So it's going to be a business decision based on the wholesaler. Now, it's not. I'm not going to be totally naive and say they're not going to be coming under great pressure from some of their larger members to extend credit now that it's allowed, but the fact remains this does not mandate it. This just allows them to extend it if they so choose to do so. This will improve or assist retailers of all sizes. That's why all retailers of all sizes in our association support this bill. It's going to help thousands of retailers, large and small, located throughout Oregon. And one of the main reasons it's going to assist them is because the extension of credit is really needed to allow the retailers to handle the processing and payment of the invoices in an efficient manner that fits into their accounting system. Again, currently of the 40 to 50,000 items we sell, the only ones we can't purchase on credit are beer and wine. So basically we've got a payment system set up on all other items where they come in, they're received, you make sure we've received the proper product and the proper amounts. It then gets routed through a payment system up to the accounting department and gets paid in a timely manner when the terms are, you know, when it's due based on the credit terms of that invoice. When it comes to beer and wine purchases, we've only got two or three options. We can either allow it to be paid by cash out of the till, which immediately causes all kinds of security risks at the front end. We can allow some folks in the management system the ability to write checks, which again creates security risks, or you can create a voucher system where you sort of have that.
What have you done?
It goes through the system and is a costly and expensive means of paying the bill. In any case, none of those allow us to use the credit system and the the accounting system that we have in place, and really that's really what we're asking for and why we're asking for this bill. That's why it's at 15 days. That's the minimum we need to really make this work in our accounting systems. It's important to note that there's only 18 other states that allow the extension of credit on beer and wine sales. So again, this isn't a case where Oregon's blazing a new path. This is something that's used and allowed in 18 other states. And again, finally, I guess the prohibition of extension of credit is obsolete and has no place in modern retailing environment. The current prohibition, again, dates back to right after prohibition was repealed. Retailing and distribution of beer and wine have fundamentally changed in the ensuing 65 years. These changes eliminate the need for cash sales of beer and wine. In closing, you're going to hear probably from some of the opponents that this is going to put some of the small distributors out of business. We adamantly disagree with that fact. Again, the distributors in this state have monopolies in their marketing areas. Terms in that they purchase beer or wine from the manufacturers to wholesale to our retailers are based on the existing business practices and the fact that there are credit sales. It's our position that if this bill was allowed and this credit began to be allowed and given to the retailers in the different marketing areas, the manufacturers are going to look at and adjust their credit positions on their sales to the wholesalers to make sure that they stay healthy and are able to continue to service their customers. You're also going to hear that this is somehow going to increase alcohol sales. We again adamantly disagree with that. This is again just a business issue. It is not going to increase the consumption of alcohol in any way that we can see. It's not going to increase the way that it's merchandised, the way that it's advertised, or the way it's displayed. It's simply going to be the way we pay for the product we bring into the stores. Frankly, what's going to occur is we're not going to be the whole warehouse for the distributors as we purchase this on cash and hold it in our retailers' back rooms and shelves until such times it's purchased and goes out through the front door. So with that, you know, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions. And if something comes to mind, and I'm going to, I guess, sort of with tongue-in-cheek close with this. The arguments, as I summarized it in 1997 session, that the distributors are going to bring to you are basically one word, because. They're going to say, we like it because it's a good deal for us, because it's always been that way, and because we don't want it to change. But they're not going to come to you and say, this is good public policy because, and give you any reason why it's good public policy. Frankly, it's an outdated situation that we think it's high time that it should be changed, and we would hope that you'd give it your positive consideration. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee? Thank you. Next, we'll call Gary Conklin. In the room.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling here today representing the Wine Growers Association in opposition to House Bill 3145. Wineries sell their products to wholesalers on credit terms, usually with payment due in 30 days. If small Oregon beer and wine distributors are pushed into cash flow bind, into a cash flow bind through the extension of credit to retailers, then it will be more difficult for them in turn to pay wineries promptly. Evidence indicates wineries are forced to accept longer credit terms in states that permit extension of credit on sales of alcoholic beverages at the retail level. Even further down the cash flow ladder are wine grape growers, who must wait for wineries to pay them. They will suffer the most if the current system is changed and credit terms and payments are extended by wholesalers to wineries. Additional financial pressure placed on small and medium-sized beer and wine distributors will accelerate consolidation of Oregon's beer and wine distribution network, which already underserves Oregon's growing wine industry. In fairness, some Oregon wineries see a value in the extension of credit to retailers for beer and wine sales. Specialty stores and restaurants may be more likely to purchase Oregon premium wines or purchase them in greater volumes if they can do so on credit terms. Over time, they feel this would give greater exposure to Oregon wines, which would be a benefit to the industry. However, the position of OWA is and has been that we oppose the extension of credit as provided for in House Bill 3145.
Questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Sandra Bishop.
Good afternoon, Chair Atkinson, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to address the committee this afternoon. I'm here representing the Wine Institute, and I want to just go through and highlight a few of the things. Some of these are out of previous testimony. This is an issue that comes before the legislature on a regular basis. That does not diminish the need to really understand the issue. I'm representing the Wine Institute. Our members number approximately 400, 450, probably up to about 500 now of the approximately 650 wineries in California. Approximately 70-75% of the wine sold in Oregon is produced in California. We produce about 80% of the wine sold in the United States.
Sandra, could you introduce yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sandra Bishop from the Wine Institute. The Wine Institute has always been opposed to extension of credit, and I'll go through some of the reasons. Basically, the extension of credit is a form of financial assistance, and as some previous speakers have alluded to, we have a three-tier system in Oregon where the producers, the wholesale distributors, and the retailers are kept separate. There's good reason for that. The Wine Institute has always supported that three-tier system and would recommend that you continue to support that and not breach it in a way such as what would happen with the use of credit. Skip a little bit here, but basically what we're looking at is that the small wineries suffer under the credit system. And as you heard, I think there's only 18 states that have credit, the others have cash. I estimate about 80% of the California wineries are small wineries. They're small ag-based businesses, family businesses. They suffer when you diminish the number of distributors and the number of small retailers starts going down, and that's what happens in the credit states. Where states have gone from cash to credit, small individual wholesalers got a sale, and it also squeezes the small retailers. In Oregon, a few years back, and I'm sure there are other people that have current statistics, but a few years back, there were 60-some wholesalers in the state. In the state of Washington, there are approximately 70 wholesalers. And both Oregon and Washington are cash states. In contrast, in the credit states of New Mexico, Nevada, and Alaska, there are only 2 to 4 wholesale distributors in those states. What has happened over the years is the number of distributors has diminished. The reason the wineries are concerned about the number of distributors is because wine is a very different product than beer. Beer is made by major brewers and it's sold in territories. Wine is not restricted to any sort of territories in Oregon, and each individual winery, no matter how small an operation, is going to be producing at least half a dozen to up to 12 different varietals. So they need to have the variety of distributors to be able to get their product out to be able to stay in business. Make no mistake, this bill is about bigger is better, and what's going to happen is the bigger businesses will thrive and the smaller businesses will go out of business. And credit also tends to diminish competition and raise prices. It will raise prices at all levels because someone has to pay for the added costs. What you're talking about now is an accounting system. The retailers are saying, we want these products to fit into our accounting system and our payment system. It's kind of a toss-up, you know, whether or not the consumer should be forced to pay higher costs because of putting them under the system, or whether it's better to keep the competition out there. Let me skip a little bit here. There's also a point I wanted to make about enforcement. There are enormous enforcement problems in some of the credit states. There's a lot of illegal activity around credit is very difficult to trace. It's very difficult to document, but it happens. It's basically in order to halt the retail wholesaler collusion that's locked out competition, or to uncover and go in and be able to adjust when different terms of credit are given to different people in the system is very difficult. We were assuming that there would be a need for additional OLCC staff to come into play for some of this enforcement. It looks like that cost may have, the sponsors of the bill may have tried to shift that cost to the courts. It doesn't matter. The cost is still there. The public's going to pay for it one way or the other, whether it's OLCC enforcement people or whether it's more activity in the courts. It's going to bring the prices up, and someone's going to end up paying for it. And the last thing I'd like to talk about is the use of credit does, in fact, change the way alcohol is marketed and sold in the states that have credit versus cash. There's a very different marketing scheme there. It leads, the use of credit at this level leads to the over-promotion of alcoholic products. And I know Mr. McCoy spoke to the fact that the grocery stores purchase 40 to 50,000 products, and beer and wine are the only products which are not allowed to be sold at credit. There's a very good reason for that, and that is they are controlled substances. People are not arrested for, you know, eating potato chips driving down the road. I mean, alcohol is a product that is reasonably and realistically under control at the state level and the federal level. And Wine Institute has always supported the kind of controls. We're very much in opposition to an increase in consumption, especially on the part of underage drinkers. So if you look at, just look in a common sense way at the use of credit, it does lead to the over-promotion of alcoholic products. You're sitting with an inventory, the bills are due, what are you going to do but try to push more product to sell it to be able to settle that credit? Just a couple other points. Litigation will absolutely blossom under this bill. There's just no way that the same credit conditions are going to be offered to every individual situation. So anytime there's any differentiation between credit terms, you've automatically got the justification for litigation. And just one clarification, that distributors don't have a monopoly on wine. They do have a monopoly on sales of beer, just for clarification for the record. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions if I could.
Questions from the committee?
Yes, I have questions.
Representative Wilson.
Could you encapsulate for us briefly the effect on smaller stores? You know, I believe I heard you mention that chances are your smaller stores would go out of business, and because that's of great concern to us representing so many small business constituencies as we do. How would you see that actually coming into play?
Well, the Chair Wilson, members of the committee, the only thing I can relate to is what's happened in other states that have transitioned from a cash system to the credit system. And they tend to lose smaller distributors and lose stores. Basically, when you're forced to extend any kind of credit, you make it a large versus small game. And some people are estimating that $1 million is not an unreasonable estimate for what you would have to come up with as far as money in the bank, basically, to extend credit at any level.
Would you, if I might follow up, would you see then the large superstores then selling alcoholic beverages at much lower prices than your small convenience stores and obviously a much, much greater volume?
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, I'm not sure I would go so far as to presume that I know anything about the pricing at the retail level. I think the issue here is that the large stores and especially the chains, would like to simply pop the alcoholic beverages into their accounting system and treat it like any other product. I don't think, I wouldn't presume, and I wouldn't assume that their motivation is to sell more at less cost. I really don't have the qualifications to answer questions about their pricing, but I think Mr. McCoy was clear, and their motivation is in their accounting system to make it easier to account for.
Good question.
Just one more, if I might. You talked about this ultimately leading to the over-promotion of alcohol sales. Would you elaborate on that?
Yes, Chair Wilson, members of the committee, it's been observed in, I'm selling broken records here in the states that have gone from cash to credit, that when you are operating under credit with alcoholic beverages, you tend to put out larger displays, you tend to put out specials, you know, whatever you can do to push that product. It becomes like any other product to be promoted in the store. The Wine Institute believes that alcohol is not an ordinary grocery product and that it's not good public policy to arbitrarily promote the sale of alcohol. It's a beverage for mature adults in moderation and that doesn't need to be promoted to be sold, but the promotion tends to happen if a retailer gets behind and has to pay off the credit.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Sandra, for coming and testifying. I'm a little bit confused. To follow up kind of on the question from Representative Wilson, this conversation about what this will do to small stores, and it seems to me, my logic would tell me that it would be tougher for the small store to come up with cash rather than to pay for this, just like they pay for everything else over credit terms. It seems to me that that would be easier for the small retail establishment. I just don't see the connection. Can you try to connect those dots?
Yes, Chair Wilson, Representative Starr. I think it has to do with magnitude. And if you're looking at a large retailer opposed to a small local grocer, they don't have the economic muscle to necessarily stay competitive if it's in a credit environment.
Well, if I can follow up with that, so they're not gonna buy the beer and wine anymore because the big guys bought it all, or I mean, I still don't get it. I guess it doesn't make sense to me. Can you try again?
Chair Wilson, Representative Starr, I'm not sure that I can answer that. I've attempted to, but I think it's more the overall environment that the larger retailers and the larger wholesalers have the advantage of having the basically deeper pockets. They have more cash to enter, they have the ability to extend more credit. The smaller stores just seem to be in other states, and I'm just simply, you know, repeating information that's passed on to me from the Wine Institute, but in other states, some of the smaller retailers seem to be more affected by the use of credit than cash. Cash kind of keeps it a little bit more in balance, but I'm maybe not answering your question. Maybe I can give an attempt and give you a written answer later to help clarify.
And just one other further on a different issue, you mentioned that there was, and this is also a follow-up with your conversation with Representative Wilson, that somehow this would promote the use of alcohol in a greater way. And I would just say that it seems to me that the manufacturers of beer especially and wine at some levels, I mean, they seem to market their product pretty well into this system. If you walk into a local convenience center, you'll see scantily dressed females, posters, or not in person necessarily, but posters or whatever, trying to market their their product. You see it on television, you see it in a lot of places. You're saying that those kinds of things would increase if we went to a credit system?
Representative Starr, Chair Wilson, Representative Starr, yes, that is correct. The experience of the Line Institute in doing some studies in transition from in states transitioning from cash to credit is that, yes, the amount of advertising and the promotions for the sale of alcohol increases when credit is brought into play versus cash. And I think I should thank you for a compliment on our effective advertising, but I'm not sure.
Any further questions? Representative Bowman.
Thank you. Hi, Ms. Bishop. I just have one question. You talked about, gosh, I lost it that quick. I guess I'll talk to you later because I can't remember it now. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Gary Oxley. Come on, Gary.
I'm not going to let a couple of young people stop you, are you?
I'd like to thank all our visiting students as they leave and welcome the new ones as they arrive. Thank you.
Would you all please introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, the committee. Gary Oxley representing Fred Meyer and Safeway Stores. With me today is Mr. Jim Rouse, Fred Meyer Financial Operations, and Bridget Flanagan, Director of Government Affairs for Fred Meyer Store, for Safeway Stores. That cost me a plant. They both have some comments that they would like to make regarding this House bill, and then I would follow their comments with my own, and we'll be very brief.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Bridget Flanagan. I'm the Public Affairs Director for Safeway here in Oregon. Our headquarters are in Clackamas, Oregon. We began operating in Oregon in the mid-1920s, and today we operate 96 stores and employ over 10,500 Oregonians, and we're actually the state's fourth largest employer. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 3145, a bill that represents to us a vital commerce issue for grocers in Oregon. House Bill 3145 is a bill that advocates a change to Oregon's liquor laws that we believe is long overdue. A large grocery store can stock as many as 60,000 items, and grocers can purchase all of those items on credit terms, except for two items, beer and wine. Current law mandates, it actually mandates, that grocers must pay for the beer or the wine prior to taking delivery of the product. This is an antiquated and out-of-sync law with today's modern business practices, and House Bill 3145 would correct that problem. Since the time shortly after Prohibition, grocers have been required, again by Oregon law, to pay for beer and wine prior to delivery, either with cash, a check, or what is called a site draft, which is similar to a check. All of these systems are burdensome, inefficient, inexpensive, and certainly less secure than paying from an invoice from a central accounting office. Oregon's out-of-date law literally requires grocers to handle the purchase of beer and wine differently than we handle every other item that we stock in our stores. Like all grocers, the 96 Safeway stores in Oregon use site drafts to pay for beer and wine. The printing, the handling, the verification of each site draft is time-consuming and it's costly. This already cumbersome system is multiplied since each of our stores can receive anywhere from 17 to 20 separate deliveries of beer and wine each week. With each delivery of beer and wine to one of our stores, it requires a lot of energy and time on the part of our store employees. First of all, the store manager, the assistant manager, the person in charge, or the inventory control clerk has to stop whatever they are doing. They have to meet the driver, verify the order, and then go to the office and write a site draft. And all of this, again, has to be done before the product's put on the shelf. Again, no other item in our stores requires this much labor or this much effort. Payment for each of those other 59,998 items that our stores stock are paid for quickly and efficiently using a computerized system from our central office. you know, for years, grocers have just been amazed that everyone in the distribution chain can buy beer and wine on credit. Again, everyone except us. Brewers can sell to distributors on credit. The state of Oregon transfers liquor to state-controlled liquor stores on bailment, which is the highest form of credit, and that means that the OLCC store doesn't pay for the product until after it sells. Oregonians who buy liquor at state-controlled liquor stores can buy it on credit simply by using a credit card. And last but not least, grocery store shoppers can buy alcoholic beverages on credit if they use a credit card when they buy their order at the check stand. So again, grocers are the only one in the whole system who are not allowed to buy alcohol on credit. We're here today to say we think something's wrong with that system, and House Bill 3145 would correct that. What this bill does is simply remove the prohibition and allows the extension of credit between the distributor and the retailer. It would allow distributors to establish reasonable credit criteria and would prohibit the discrimination against any retailer, large or small, who meets the distributor's credit criteria. The bill does not require a distributor to extend credit to a retailer if they don't get credit from a manufacturer. The bill also provides for legal sanctions in the event that either side tries to circumnavigate the law. And I'd like to just reflect on one point. Grocers are not going to stop carrying a particular item or buy from a different distributor if we don't get credit from distributor number one, say. First of all, as long as there is consumer demand for a product, grocers are going to carry the item. That has been and always will be the single determining criteria. But more importantly, please remember that grocers are prohibited by law from buying the same item from a beer distributor from another area due to what's called Oregon's beer territories. Distributors have what amounts to simply a state-sanctioned monopoly. Grocers can only buy beer from the distributor in their area. We have no choice. So we can't change distributors, and we're certainly not going to stop carrying an item that our customers want. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it's time to end the protectionism enjoyed by Oregon distributors for the past 60-plus years. Protectionism for one segment of the industry at the expense of another is simply wrong. With that, I will close with the committee's urging that you pass House Bill 3145. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Strauss, and I work in the Operations Support Department for Fred Meyer at the corporate office. I have an opportunity to work with the accounts payable, with individuals in the stores who escort the driver to the customer service desk so that they can be paid, with the customer service desk people where we have to have special arrangements to make payment to the vendor, with the receiving clerks at the back door who receive this particular product differently than they do any other product. And we, as a company, market and merchandise to states both who are COD and who are credit. And we don't merchandise our beer and wine any differently in the states that are credit than those that are not credit. We don't advertise any differently. If you went into one Fred Meyer store in a COD state and a Fred Meyer store in a credit state, it would be the same. Because we are required to pay cash when our vendors deliver product, it creates a number of awkwardnesses, difficulties for our company. In accounts payable, from time to time, a vendor is paid twice because they're paid cash at the back door, and then there is a systems difficulty that results in a double payment. Our receiving clerks at the back door have to make sure that they do things a certain way for these particular vendors. Our customer service desk people have to make sure that they follow certain procedures that have to be established just for the beer and wine vendors. And I want to say that this bill brings about a standardization for our company that will help us not to increase the price of alcohol. If anything, our expenses are lessened because we can use the same accounting system that we do use for all other vendors. Thank you very much. Mr. Strauss, could you please explain how double payment works again?
Yes. Okay, if a vendor is paid at the back door, mm-hmm. that is the receiving area, with cash, and then there is an error in the accounting system, because we pay all of our other vendors through the accounting system electronically, it is possible for a vendor to be paid both from accounts payable and at the store level. And sometimes it takes quite a while to catch that double payment.
I'll just call and say.
Further questions? Mr. Wilson?
Yes. I have heard, and forgive me if I've missed this testimony today, I had to run and testify in another committee, but I've heard over time, and I can't tell you from whom, that going to a credit system would change the shelf content, the entire orientation of how shelves would be stocked with particular beverages. And I'm not sure where I heard that, but is that the case? Is it a possibility? Have you heard that? Could you comment on that?
Well, my response would be, as I said before, in the stores in the states where we pay with credit, we stock our beer and wine the same way that we do in the other states, where we pay with cash.
Well, let me follow that up. Have you heard anything to the alternative to that? Heard any other stories, horror stories about wars in the aisles between shelf stockers and things like that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, again, Gary Oxley representing Fred Meyer and Safeway Stores. I believe you're talking about an issue that is characteristic and common within the grocery industry, shelving allowances. Shelving allowances are prohibited under tight house laws in the state of Oregon. This bill, House Bill 3145, has absolutely nothing to do with shelf placement of alcoholic products. That is one of the many arguments that's brought into the great scheme of this in terms of making it convoluted and complicated. And I urge you to stay focused on the bill as it is. This simply relates to the issue of credit and not the placement of product. There is, in fact, product placement that's done on other commodities and products in the state. We are prohibited by law from entering that realm with alcohol. And that is not what this bill is about.
One follow-up. I want to talk about the intermingling of alcohol products that are bought on credit versus those that are cash on the barrel, so to speak. What could happen, or what could you foresee happening in a situation where a certain distributor is offering an establishment credit but may not be offering another one that they serve credit? Not a consistent policy. One perhaps isn't credit worthy, and so they want to go cash on the barrel. Another one is credit worthy, and so they do extend credit. How could that play out, or describe for me a scenario that could happen there?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that scenario plays out every day in every business transaction that's conducted in the state of Oregon and across the United States, whether it's computers, whether it's pretzels, or whether it's television sets. That issue is played out between the manufacturer, retailer, and distributor in that process. And if a retailer of television sets is not creditworthy, they're probably not going to receive credit from a vendor or manufacturer, distributor, wherever their linkage happens to be. So it would be no different in the retail grocery industry. If somebody is not creditworthy, they should not receive credit. And consequently, since we are prohibited from buying from another distributor of that same product in a given territory, the retailers simply have to pay cash to that distributor. So there is no loss of product. The retailer buys that product based upon what his customers want to purchase when they go in that store.
I'll follow up one more time. I wanted to ask about alcohol pricing in general. Is there much price difference in, say, a case at Fred Meyer versus a case at Safeway? And if there is, what are the incentives that make the price difference in a case like that?
Now, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we need to be very cautious in terms of addressing how individual companies price their products. Two individuals sitting before you today certainly can't go into that. There are certain federal laws that prohibit that.
There are differences.
But there certainly are differences. There are differences in the price of oranges. There are differences in the price of potato chips and potatoes. So all of those factors are created in terms of what the season is, what they want to advertise, and how those individual and various companies choose to price products themselves.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, could I add one comment? Earlier, for the record again, Bridget Flanagan, Safeway Stores, just responding to a comment that I believe Ms. Bishop made about how alcohol should be treated differently because it's different than eating a bag of potato chips driving down the street. We also sell a number of other controlled substances, including tobacco items and pharmaceuticals for our drug stores. We are able to buy those on credit terms, so there is no difference in our opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again for the record, Gary Oxley representing Fred Meyer Safeway Stores. I will make my remarks very brief. In 1933, by special order of a special session of the Oregon Legislature, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission was created. And it was established for the purpose of, number one, controlling distilled spirits through state-controlled stores, and the second purpose was to license and control the sale of beer and wine and hard liquor through single-by-the-drink establishments and through package stores. Over the course of many years, the legislature has changed laws pertaining to the sale of alcohol, and the Liquor Commission has written and changed numerous rules pertaining to the sale. And over the period of time, some of those rules have been changed because they become obsolete, they become old, and it's necessary to change or modify them. This legislative body meets every other year in the state of Oregon for the purpose of debating public policy, for the purpose of enacting new laws, for the purpose of modifying existing laws, and repealing laws that are outdated and should be replaced. That is simply what we are asking you to do with House Bill 3145. We are asking you to repeal an outdated law. It is ironic that the largest employer in the state of Oregon is sitting before you today, and the fourth largest employer in the state of Oregon sitting before you today cannot purchase beer and wine on credit. We ask you to think about that. We ask you to think through the logic and answer that question. Why not? As Ms. Flanagan pointed out, we sell controlled substances to our pharmacies. Both of these employers have pharmacies in their stores, and they sell controlled substances, and they buy those controlled substances on credit. We ask you to think this through. We ask for your support of the bill. I've been told this afternoon the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is neutral on this bill, so they are not in opposition to it. With that, we urge you to give strong consideration to passage of House Bill 3145. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And lastly, Mr. Paul Romay. On down.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, based on Steve McCoy's testimony, I should just say cuz and then leave, but I won't. I'll try to give you a little bit of history.
Mr. Romain,
yes.
Could you please state your name for the record?
I'm Paul Romain. I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. Thank you. Sorry, I missed on that one. I don't know exactly what testimony to give. I've given testimony on this issue every 2 years since 1985. First year I represented the beer and wine distributors here. And it's been in the House, it's been in the Senate, it's been in Democratic control, Republican control, and every 2 years it comes back up. Again, that doesn't diminish the importance of the issue. It's very important to certain people, and so therefore it will keep coming back up. And I intend to make a living off of this for the rest of my life, I think, but that's fine. Now, I think what I'll do is answer a couple of questions first and then get into the specifics, because there was some questions, very good questions out there about why we have this system, the benefit of this system, what it does to different people. Chair Wilson, all right, are you chair now or is this you? Okay, all right, Chair Wilson. I didn't see the passing of the gavel. Had asked a question about small stores, and Representative Starr also the same basic question. In Oregon, ever since Prohibition, there's been one overriding factor about purchase of beer and wine in Oregon, and that is everybody, big or small, purchases it at the exact same price on the exact same terms. That's the basic thread that runs through the liquor control laws in this state. So, for example, beer and wine are the only products on the shelf of all the grocers, Costco down to your corner mom-and-pop shop, where they purchased that product for the exact same price. Exact. So it's up to them, that small store, to decide what kind of markup it wants to make on the product. So it, frankly, is the only product where it can compete with everything else out there. That's how it benefits the small grocer. If you go to a credit situation, whatever the terms are, you allow us now to discriminate, and we will discriminate. And we will discriminate based upon a number of factors, the main one being probably quantity. So if you want quantity, then you'll get credit. If you don't want quantity, you will not get credit. And that's how it will affect the small stores. It is by far cheaper for us to deliver to the people who are up here, Fred Meyer, Safeway, even cheaper for us to deliver to a Costco, a warehouse shop. It's very expensive for us to deliver to a small shop on the coast in southern Oregon and other places in Klamath Falls and other places around the state. Much more expensive. Those shops will not get the same terms. Very simple. What the law does in Oregon is it allows every manufacturer an opportunity to get on the shelf. And one of the advantages of this bill coming up every 2 years is that you go through a lot of different hearings. So you get to learn a lot about the industry. And believe me, I started off originally not knowing anything about this, and I've learned far more than I ever want to know. And unfortunately for you, you're going to learn far more than you ever wanted to know about this. But very interesting, in the interim before the 85 session, there was an interim committee that studied the marketing of alcoholic products and the marketing of other products. It was chaired by Representative Eldon Johnson and Senator Bill Kenemer. They went into it predisposed to go to credit. That was the reason they created the interim committee, because they couldn't quite get it out of the Senate, but they wanted to have something. By the time we finished that hearing and we learned how product is marketed, Representative Johnson introduced a bill that would have mandated basically that all products be marketed like alcoholic beverages. In fact, what you'll find on the shelf is alcoholic beverages are on the shelf not because of any purchase of shelf space, not because of any extension of credit or other special terms. They're on the shelf simply because the grocer feels that a customer is going to buy it, because there's no other incentive to put it on. That's not the case with every other product out there. That's not the case when you go into the dog food section or the bread section or anything else. You have a couple of manufacturers, that's it. If you go into the beer and wine section, you have a wide range of manufacturers who can market their product. And what you find, and that's the reason why the beer and wine, the brew pub folks, the small microbreweries, support us 100% in opposing credit. It's why the wineries have been very active in opposing credit. There was also mentioned earlier that we get credit in the beer side. I'll talk about that because you've already been inundated with wine information. From the major brewers, we do get some credit from some brewers. Usually it's between 3 and 7 days credit, depending on the brewery. We take possession of that product the minute it leaves the brewery, and that's when the credit terms start. So usually it's not even at our warehouse by the time the credit terms have ended. We also have an inventory requirement with our breweries of 30 to 45 days. So we are, in fact, their storage facility, and we have to inventory that product there. A grocer does not. And if the grocers keep insisting that they want credit, then we'd like to mandate inventory. And we'd be more than happy to trade the exact credit terms we get if they will have a 30 to 45 day supply of product. Contrary, the large grocers get service from a distributor 3, 4, sometimes 5 days a week, bringing product in. Their warehouse space is minimal. We do the work for them. I'm going to take you back a little bit in history, because there's an old saying that if you forget history, you're condemned to repeat it. And in 1934, actually, the Oregon legislature in special session put in a bill called the Knox Act, which was a response to prohibition. We basically authorized the sale of alcohol. Part of that Knox Act was this credit provision, ban on credit, only cash, and no other financial arrangements. We cannot have an interest in a retailer. The original intent behind that was very simple, to somehow separate the tiers so you didn't have the abuses that you had pre-prohibition, where you had basically breweries owning the retailers and shoving the product out the door. Now, in the modern age, I'm not sure that would occur again. But totally inadvertently, as most things usually happen, you've created probably the best antitrust laws around. You've created a system where the little guy thrives. And if you look at the market out there, with the Oregon wine growing industry, which has gone berserk, the brew pub industry, where we are the number one brew pub state in the entire country, about 10% of the Oregon market for beer is Oregon-produced micro beer. Portland is the largest, has more breweries per capita than I think any city in the world. This is a hub of activity. And part of it, frankly, according to the brew pub people, is the fact that they can get on the shelf here. Whereas in other states, they're fighting. They can't give the terms to get on the shelf. And credit opens that door. And that's why a number of you through the years have received various phone calls from various breweries or wineries or other folks saying, don't do this, please. What, from our parochial standpoint, purely parochial standpoint, from beer, wine, distributor, you're basically saying to us, assuming we said no discrimination, we're just going to, and I saw the eyes, I'm going to quit soon. If we are all of a sudden told that we have to extend credit, and somehow the vast majority of our accounts we have to give credit to, you're talking about a beer and wine distributor saying no income for 15 days, probably more than that, because as much as some of the grocery industry says that they love to pay in this specified period of time, I will wager you it goes well beyond that. That means you have no income. You have to go out and borrow that money. It was very interesting. When this bill came up in the Senate in the late 80s, I had one distributor, a very large distributor out of Portland, who came down and testified. And his testimony is very simple. He goes, I don't know whether I'm for it or against it. Because if you pass this bill, the small guys are going to be ripe for me to buy them out, because they're not going to be able to go out there and get the stuff. I can't. The big guy can handle it. And I'd be trying to fool you if I said the big guy couldn't handle all this stuff. They can. It's the small guy we're talking about. I'm not going to bore you much more. Except to tell you that in 1995, we actually did pass a little modification. We allowed for electronic funds transfer. That was going to be the save-all, and the grocers were good about it. They were going to allow for electronic funds transfer, and nobody has ever taken advantage of it at all. So with that, I will close my testimony, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, I think Mr. Romaine is the last one signed to testify. Is there anyone else here to do so? All right, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3145. And now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3175. And Representative Bowman?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Joanne Bowman, state representative. I represent District 19 in Northeast Portland. First, I want to thank the chair for scheduling House Bill 3175. This is one of those few bills this session that actually has true bipartisan support because it's an excellent bill, and I hope you will agree after I've presented it. This bill would require the Oregon Racing Commission to regulate the breeding of greyhounds for racing. Currently, the breeding of greyhounds is currently unregulated. The USDA regulates the breeding of dogs for pet commerce and for research purposes, but does not regulate the breeding of racing dogs. The Oregon Department of Agriculture does not regulate the breeding of dogs for racing, and there is no such regulation anywhere in Oregon statute. Many cases of abuse and neglect have occurred on breeding farms. From 1990 to 1997, there have been over 50 cases of abuse and neglect documented by the media within the dog racing industry. Many of these cases were on breeding farms. Until we have an accountable law in the books to safeguard the breeding of greyhounds while they are on breeding farms, we have no way of knowing whether abuses are occurring in Oregon or not. Unlike USDA rules in dealing with the breeding of dogs for pet commerce, House Bill 3175 does not call for spot inspections. HB 3175 has no anticipated fiscal impact. And in speaking with racing industry representatives, I have not been informed of any outright opposition to this legislation. I have sitting here to my left Mr. Curry Teal, and he will be giving you some more detailed testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Chair Wilson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Curry Teal. I'm the co-author of 3175, and first I'd like to thank you for the honor of being here today. I think Representative Bowman pretty much covered it. I will expand on that briefly and then end with a very short, I believe about 3.5 minute video and take any questions you might have. I think this is more than anything just a simple legal oversight, as Representative Bowman pointed out. The USDA regulates the breeding of dogs for pet commerce and for medical research purposes, but does not regulate the breeding of dogs for racing. There have been a number of problems within the dog racing industry, particularly on breeding farms. Unfortunately, we're dealing with a business, and occasionally you have people who need to pay the rent, so to speak, and don't take under consideration the welfare of animals, unfortunately. This bill was written very, very narrowly, and that was intentional. I took most of the language from ORS 462.270. If you look at the bill, you can see that Section 4 is essentially Section 1, but applying it to racing dogs as opposed to race meats themselves. In ORS 462.270, it uses the words license, regulate, and supervise. And in 3175, I'm only using the word regulate. I'm not using the word license or supervise, again, with the intent of making this bill very narrowly defined and straightforward. There have been concerns that this would somehow cause the licensing of the breeding of greyhounds. As you can see, the bill is just not written that way. Section 5, again, is simply Section 3 from 462.270, cut down to simply take what we need and leave out the things we don't need. As Representative Bowman pointed out, there's no anticipated fiscal impact, and in speaking with Representative Witt, who is a co-sponsor of this bill, his comment to me was that he liked this bill because there was minimal government intrusion, as he put it, which I think is, again, a testament to the narrow way in which this bill was written. This bill does have, I believe, 14 co-sponsors. In conclusion, I would just like to add that this does not solve all the problems within the dog racing industry. And one thing I don't want to have happen is I don't want this body to pass this bill and feel as if they've solved those problems. There have been over 50 cases between 1990 and 1997 of abuse and neglect documented by the media. There's just simply not enough homes for all the dogs. That's really what it comes down to. The Humane Society of the United States estimates there are around 40,000 dogs killed annually within the dog racing industry. Dog racing industry officials admit to just under 20,000. So whether it's 20 or 40, the fact remains there just aren't enough homes for all the dogs. And I would add that the Oregon Racing Commission has been at the forefront of trying to change that and trying to do things the right way, and their adoption programs have been models for the rest of the country. But it's just simply not enough. You're going to hear that this bill is not necessary. And my response to that is that we need to have a system of accountability in place on this issue. The Oregon Racing Commission, as I understand it, does do some of this, but if they are doing it, and to what extent they are doing it, they would be doing that without the statutory authority and also without the accountability that comes with a statute with a law in the books. So while you're seeing this video, I would just ask you, do you think it is important to have a certain amount of accountability on this issue? I think it is. I'm hoping you'll concur with me and pass this to the floor today with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Sinceri.
Maybe I misunderstood what you said. Did you say that Representative Witt was a co-sponsor on this?
That's correct, Representative. The bill has not been reprinted. However, both Representatives Witt and Mannix, along with Lowe, Deckert, Rosenbaum, Kafuri, and a number of others are co-sponsors. I believe there's 14 total representatives.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Representative Sinceri, I do have the list here of people who've signed on if you would like to see it.
I believe it.
Thank you. Could you go ahead and roll your tape, and then we'll see if we have some questions for you after that.
Representative. You ever seen Witt and Bowman on the same bill?
That's what we were just talking about. That's like a Sinceri and Bowman bill.
No, they're
going after the glycerin pills.
Witt and Bowman are the two single no votes on more bills than any other pair.
They're keeping score, you know.
Yeah.
I think I beat Witt on that.
I'm sure you do. I'm kidding.
It's the unregulated farm where the dogs spend most of their lives. After a three-day wait at the breeding farm near Ballinger, the Reynolds County Sheriff has just told owner Jim McCord they're taking his dog.
This is from a Texas talk show.
Scott Armstrong and a small army of volunteers have moved in for the rescue. The sheriff and his officers stand and watch while they carry off dozens of starving dogs. McCord is angry.
Here's Scott Armstrong. What's my husband doing there? Well, for one thing, they're living in terrible conditions out there. One of the people that didn't come to me. Well, it's not my job to. That's your job.
One old female that can barely walk looks like a skeleton with skin.
They should not fall out.
This is from National Geographic Explorer, 1997, this next segment.
Hundreds of miles from the track in northern Florida, the lush landscape is dotted with greyhound farms. Many retired racers are sent back to these remote parts. What happens to them here can easily go unnoticed.
Hope you'll forgive the dramatic nature. It's National Geographic, after all.
County is home to more than 60 greyhound farms and one deputy sheriff for animal cruelty. Jay Perrette is an author. authorized to make spot checks on farms. To make a surprise inspection, she must be summoned by someone who's witnessed serious abuse. It was such a call that led her to a farm near Ocala. 25 years on the job hadn't prepared her for what she was about to see. The scene was recorded on the home video camera.
When I walked into this car, the stench was so bad that your eyes immediately started watering into the urine. I mean, it was enough that you had to literally walk back outside and take a deep breath before you were able to deal with the problems in here.
Deputy Tourette found 196 desperately neglected greyhounds crammed into filthy cages.
The animals were packed into these crates, 2 to 3 to a crate with muzzles on. They were deep in their own feces. They were laying in their own urine. They were literally starving to death in this room right here. It was one of the saddest things I've ever seen. I did a lot of crying that day because, you know, we thought we were going to lose a lot of the animals. It was just a horrible, horrible thing.
The dogs were victims of a bungled scheme to ship retired racers to tracks in Venezuela. When plans faltered and money ran out, they, like other rejected greyhounds, became worthless to their keepers. The dogs' caretakers were found at the site and arrested. Volunteers rushed to the greyhound aid, treating some on the spot and evacuating others to shelters nearby. But they were the lucky ones. Just beyond the kennel, there were signs of a freshly covered pit. Deputy Perret and others began to investigate.
Looks like that car, the wind came here. Oh, wait, what have I got in here? I got a first stall, I think. Yeah. First stall.
At least 12 dogs that died before the raid were buried here.
And Steve, he was young.
It was a gruesome sight, but critics claim that in areas where greyhounds are bred, it's no exception. But Deputy Barrett believes that some cases like this one could be prevented.
If there's a law in the books that allows law enforcement or cruelty investigators to be able to come on the greyhound farm and to be able to walk up on the property and say, I'm here to inspect your farm and be allowed to do so, it would help our job tremendously, because without that, this is going to continue to happen.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Terry before we move on to our
other witnesses there?
Question.
Representative Beck.
Do we know how many greyhound farms there are in Oregon? Greyhound breeders?
My understanding, Representative, and I think that would be a question better suited for Mr. Barham, but my understanding is it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 or so. That may be inaccurate, though, so I would turn that question to Mr. Barham, but I know there is a significant number.
There's someone else that can answer that, then. Okay.
Right. Representative Thompson.
Do you have any evidence of anything like this going on in the state of Oregon?
Representative Thompson, I would again suggest that until we have a system of accountability or a statute on the books, there's really no way of knowing. But as far as I know, I do not know of any cases like this in Oregon.
Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to invite up Charlie Williamson, Oregon Greyhound Breeders Association. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm sorry that we're not passing laws for Texas and Florida today. My name is Charles Williamson. I'm an attorney and a lobbyist from Portland. I represent the Oregon Greyhound Breeders Association. We have approximately 100 members, but there's really only about 16 farms that raise greyhounds in Oregon for racing at the Multnomah Kennel Club track, Multnomah Greyhound Park. There are, in our industry, owners, trainers, kennel and farm owners, there's veterinarians, folks that sell fencing, supplies, medicines, transportation, and similar products to the industry. It employs several hundred people in addition to the many that are employed at the racing track. This bill presents us with the old no-win question: if you stop beating your wife, if we're in favor of the bill, it means we think there's an abuse in Oregon that needs to be stopped, and if we're against it, it means we want to continue to mistreat animals. And neither is correct. And it's also not correct that there's no existing law, which I'll get to in a minute. Oregon greyhounds are not maltreated, and while abuses can occur in the past, or it can occur, the state has plenty of authority already to regulate this, and does regulate it very, very tightly. So this bill, whether it passes or not, will have a zero effect on the greyhound industry. I'd like to draw your attention to the statutes that I have attached to my testimony. Everybody that handles racing greyhounds, whether they're grooms, trainers, the kennels, the farms, everybody has to have a license from the Oregon Racing Commission. The commission can revoke that license, put people out of business if they violated any rule of the commission. They can revoke the license if it's not in the best interest of racing. I call your attention to ORS 462-270, which is about four pages down, which says the commission, in existing law, the commission shall prepare and promulgate a set of rules to govern, and to skip down, it says humane practices and any other manner conducting pertaining to the good conduct of racing. And the commission does do that, and I've attached the rules, which again show everyone that has to be licensed. And in OAR 462-021-0015, number 9, I've highlighted that for you, all licensees, farm owners, kennel owners, everybody that gets a license is consenting by the taking of a license to warrantless searches of their premises by the commission. The commission has goes into their financial responsibility to be able to care for the animals. The commission specifically provides that their license will be denied if their kennel is a danger to the physical safety of the greyhounds, or does not have adequate security, is not sanitary, does not have good air circulation for the animals. Under Section Division 25, specifically provides no person shall submit any animal in their charge to cruel or inhumane treatment. Cruel or inhumane treatment includes, but is not limited to, lack of adequate food, shelter, and water, neglect in any manner, including adequate veterinarian care and attention when necessary, conditions which cause the animal to give the appearance of physical pain or suffering, and then it refers, or anything that's in violation of the criminal laws. And I've attached copies of the criminal laws as well that point out that it's a crime in Oregon to cause negligent or intentional harm to an animal. You have to provide appropriate number of people on your place to care for the animals. You have to have adequate transportation for the animals. You have to have adequate fire protection for the animals. This is something that the Oregon Racing Commission does look at now very, very closely, and which is a violation of two or four criminal laws that I've attached to the testimony. In addition to that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the commission has set up programs through our association, through the association which Paul Romaine represents of Oregon Racing Kennels,
primarily the Oregon Greyhound Association and another farm inspection association, farm, or the Greyhound Farms of Oregon, where we inspect farms quarterly, and we turn our inspections over to the commission. Every racing greyhound has to be registered with the National Greyhound Association. The National Greyhound Association inspects farms approximately once a year, but they do say that they don't come to Oregon very much. They'll sometimes skip Oregon because Oregon does so well, and they want to put their efforts into states where it is needed. Similarly, the Oregon Racing Commission now inspects greyhound farms approximately, at least they endeavor to do it, once a year.
If I may interrupt you for just a moment, let me ask you, in that every greyhound is currently registered, would you interpret that as a regulation on the breeding of greyhounds, or just simply a registry of those that that have? The reason I'm asking that, here on line 21 of the printed bill, we see a request that the commission shall regulate the breeding of greyhounds. So I'd like to ask you how you would interpret that.
Well, that's one place our membership has some concern, that the actual breeding or mating of animals is a rather technical thing. Of, you know, when a greyhound is in heat, what studs may be available, how much money you have. It's a rather you know, and you also have to look at bloodlines, racing histories, ancestry, and so forth to breed dogs. This is something that, I mean, certainly the commission can regulate humane treatment, but our members would prefer that we didn't have to get the permissions, the commission's approval before dogs are actually bred to each other. We did have a suggestion, if you do want to pass the bill, that you take out the words breeding and insert the words care and welfare, which I think is really more consistent with the sponsor's intent, and that would certainly include humane treatment with respect to breeding. And one other thought, which I didn't put in the hand and gross version that's at the back of your package, but we don't see any reason why greyhounds should be singled out in this particular bill, and why it shouldn't apply to all racing animals in Oregon is another thought that has been mentioned to us.
Okay, thank you. Representative Sanceri.
Isn't it true, and maybe you covered this and I missed it, isn't it true that there is an excellent program to the public for retired racers in the state of Oregon?
There's
many, if not most, of the dogs find their way into a good home after their racing years are done.
That's correct. I should have mentioned that Mr. Romain's group runs that, funds that program, and many hundreds of greyhounds are adopted out.
Thank you. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Williamson. First, I want to make a short comment, and then I have a question. Your statement put me off immediately when you talked about, have you stopped beating your wife? You may not know this, and of course you wouldn't because you don't know me, but I was an abused wife at one time, and so I wasn't amused when I saw that in your statement. So maybe you want to think about who your audience is the next time you present something like that.
I'm very sorry if that offended you, Representative.
It did. Thank you. Now, the bill in front of us really deals with the breeding of greyhounds. It doesn't deal the regulations that you've pointed out are the ones that deal with specifically the racing, and this bill deals with another avenue, which is the breeding of greyhounds. Even though they're being breeded for racing, the bill is real clear about that. So we're not talking about what you're currently doing, but this is an addition to what the current responsibility is and the statutes. Would you care to comment?
I do not believe that the language of the bill does anything more than existing statutes do.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Thompson.
Have there been any incidences where any of the Oregon breeders have ever been, say in the last 2 years, been accused of inhumane treatment of their animals?
You know, I can't say there's never been any inhumane treatment in Oregon. The commission does regulate this industry. They do inspect, and from time to time
suspect they, I don't know of a specific case, but I suspect they do suggest to people that there are certain things be done to clean up a farm. I don't think we've had anything like the show here, but I'm not aware of any percent option.
We're off to the races in case.
Thing you know, a mechanical rabbit hole.
You actually put him up to that, didn't you?
Are there any other questions? Representative Deckard.
Sure. I just have one quick question, Charlie. And why do we tend to hear, I've heard more and since I've been in the legislature about greyhounds and the video than other, I guess, aspects? Do you know, and it might be more national scope, but I just seem...
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Deckard, there is a national sort of movement to try and put greyhound racing out of business. I think that there is, people do feel the dogs are mistreated nationally, and I think that is a goal of some activists in the area. And I mean, historically and in other states, there have been abuses that have occurred, and we are working very hard. I mean, it's the racetrack here, the industry knows that this is something that would not be tolerated in Oregon, and we're working very hard to be sure that it doesn't happen, because it is a place that the industry would be vulnerable. And we want to save the industry. We want, even though we've had so much trouble with video poker and the declining handle, we're doing everything we can to be sure that it's a clean and humane industry.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it. We've got an absolute clear-out time of 3:15 in this room. I understand people far more important than we are coming in here about that time, so we've got to move ahead. Our final witness here is Steve, and Steve, I'm sorry, Barhan, Oregon Racing Commission, please. Steve, after you identify yourself for the record, I'd like to ask you a question.
My name's Steve Barham. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Racing Commission.
Thank you. Thank you. I wanted to ask a question right up front here. You've had a chance to look at House Bill 3175. The assertion has been made that the adoption of 3175 would not augment anything that is currently on the books, either through statute or administrative rule. Could you address that?
Mr. Chairman, I think that the most it would do is clarify that the legislature wants us to do what we're already doing. The racing, to start out with, is a what the lawyers call a pervasively regulated industry. Mr. Williamson talked about when people take out licenses, they agree to warrantless searches. You know, there's this thing called the Constitution out there that maybe sometimes says you have to have more cause than what we have to cause, but that's part of the price of racing and those things. About 10 years ago, the commission looked at the broad statutory authority it has and saw some of the issues that happened in other states. And I would point the committee's attention to that those are not Oregon, and also the time period. About 10 years ago, we became very active in this area. With a supportive but maybe reluctant industry. I mean, opening up your house or your property to the state to come in, it makes people a little reluctant. Now that has moved, in my opinion, to a aggressively supportive and sometimes even what I would call demanding industry for regulation to make sure that we never have something like that. An example of that, each year we have our greyhound judges and the industry go through the rules of racing for greyhounds. And the Oregon Greyhound Farmers Association came up with a proposal and beat us over the head with it, and I guess until we adopted it, that says we want to be licensed as farmers. And part of that is that if a greyhound isn't whelped and on a licensed greyhound farm for the first 12 months of its life, that person doesn't get to share an Oregon bred bonus. Okay? Because we're not going to have bad treatment, and we're not going to have conditions that should not be there. I guess that talks around your question, but it's about the best I can do, I think.
Thank you. Questions? Let me ask briefly, what is the Oregon Racing Commission? What do you cover? Who's on it? How many members?
Okay, the Oregon Racing Commission is a 5-member commission. They're appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. They are the policy-making body of the agency. They have quasi-legal and judicial authority as well as executive authority. They hire the executive director, which is me. I'm responsible for the day-to-day operation of the agency, and I supervise all staff. Broad components of staff are the stewards and judges. Depending on if it's horse racing or greyhound racing, we regulate both. We have auditors. We have licensing staff. Auditors are to audit the paramutual things. We have investigators who investigate alleged violations of racing law and statute. And we have veterinarians on staff. We also regulate all of the simulcast in of out-of-state signal and off-track sites.
Thank you. In interpreting 3175, the commission shall regulate the breeding of greyhounds. How do you interpret the word shall regulate the breeding of?
Mr. Chairman, when I first read it, I guess I just kind of glossed over the top of it. To me, that means the location in which they are bred, not the act itself, or deciding which two greyhounds are bred together. Probably to make that more clear, if in fact the committee wants to pass this out, would put the facilities used for breeding. I would go, I mean, to not have us do any more than what we're currently doing, you could actually put in facilities used for breeding, raising, and kenneling of greyhounds. I mean, to us, because of the Oregon Bred program and the bonus program, we have to make sure that an Oregon Bred is actually an Oregon Bred, and that starts from the time it's whelped. And, you know, the commission simply does not tolerate anything other than that.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate that. Mr. Teal, would you come back up again, please?
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Carrie Teal.
Thank you. Wanted to ask you about your intent. We've asked everybody else. I guess we better get around to asking you.
Certainly, Representative. First of all, in looking at ORS 462.270, I also am somewhat familiar with these statutes. If you look at Section 1, it specifically relates to race meets. The Oregon Racing Commission shall license, regulate, and supervise all race meets. Section 2, again, specifically applies to race meets. The commission shall be the sole judge of whether or not a race meets. Section 3, again, a complete set of rules to govern the race meets in every phase of operation. This statute is defined as the duties of the commission. So I guess I would ask Mr. Williamson if he can show me a statute that specifically addresses the breeding of greyhounds, because I haven't seen one. And looking over the statute time and time again, my understanding is there are administrative rules. That confounds me a little bit, because my understanding is administrative rules are intended to be an interpretation of the statute, and if there's no statutory authority, I'm not sure how those administrative rules were written. However, I do acknowledge that I've been told there are some. I have not seen those, although apparently you have now. And I do acknowledge that the Racing Commission has intently and strongly tried to work on this issue and make sure that these are addressed. I don't feel that addresses the concerns with dog racing in general. I don't feel that's enough.
When you're talking about between $20,000 and $40,000 dogs each year being put down, I still think that's a problem.
So then you're concerned about the turning out of an overabundance of
that's,
dogs?
It's the dog racing industry, that is essentially one of the main problems, Representative. You have people who will essentially overbreed because they want as many potential winners as possible. And then at some point, whether it's on the breeding farm or at the end of their racing career or mid-racing career, they will weed out the dogs that simply aren't winners. What happens to those dogs? Obviously, a lot of them are adopted. Some of them end up in research facilities. Some of them end up in mass graves. That's just the way it happens. Does it happen here in Oregon? We don't know. What I do know, the Oregon Racing Commission has strongly and intently tried to take care of that problem. But I do think that the breeding of greyhounds is at the core of the discarding of dogs, so to speak. So I find it hard to believe that it would be a problem to put in the statutes to create a statutory authority saying that we need to regulate the breeding of these dogs. My intent was not in any way to give the commission the ability to choose who bred with who. Obviously, there's no licensing language in this bill, and I would be fully supportive of an amendment simply saying nothing in this act applies to the selection of who breeds with who, that type of thing. I would be fully supportive of that because that was not my intent in any way.
But then we would be limiting a particular breeder to how many dogs could be whelped in a particular year, something like that?
Chair Wilson, that was not my intent. My intent was simply to make sure the commission is looking at the breeding of dogs, making sure these abuses weren't happening. Obviously, I think it would help within the industry if you did put a certain limit on the number of dogs that can be whelped. But I think that's a business decision, and I'm certainly not supportive of that at this point or suggesting that.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? All right, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. We'll close the works or the public hearing on House Bill 3175. And if this is to go any further, I would like to get the parties together to we could talk about this because obviously we need to cover some ground that we're a little fuzzy on. Okay. What I'd like to do is open a work session on House Bill 2574 and is...
I'll do it for you.
Okay. Very good. Kara, tell us more about this, please.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the public contracting bill that has to do with drug testing. We have -3 amendments, but Mr. Shipwreck was not available today. They specify that the measure will only apply to public improvement contracts and that it only applies to an employee drug testing program being in place. That's what the dash reads to. So it eliminates the concern about, you know, pencil suppliers.
Yeah, I have no -3s. How are we doing on -3s?
I was saying it.
Okay.
We're lacking -3s?
No.
Yes.
Yep. F2s.
No -3s. From here, yeah, say, can we get some more -3s?
-3s.
Oh, guys, we have been at your spot. Are they at your spot?
No.
No.
Are we in work session?
Yes, we are.
You are looking for a motion?
As soon as we got all these things, the answer is probably yes, but let's get all these out here.
Everybody got a copy now?
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay, so once again, now that we have our -3s, would you explain, once again, I'm sorry to put you through that, but
okay.
I was busy looking for my -3s.
I apologize. The -3s clarify that the bill applies only to public improvement contracts, and the only requirement is that the contractor demonstrate that a drug testing program is in place. There's nothing, it removes all the references to rehabilitation programs and those sorts of concerns. It addresses the associated builder and contractor concerns. and also addresses the Department of Administrative Services concerns about pencil suppliers and that kind of thing. This only applies to public improvement construction type projects.
All right, very good.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Starr?
I would move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2574.
Representative Starr moves the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2574. Is there any discussion? All right, seeing none, clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Yes.
Decker?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Aye.
Thompson?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye. Dash 3 amendments are adopted. I'll entertain another motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2574 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Starr moves House Bill 2574 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? All right. Hearing none. Clerk, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Jack?
Aye.
Bowman?
Yes.
Decker?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. House Bill 2574 is adopted, and Representative Starr?
Representative Gardner.
Oh, Gardner will. Okay. We'll have Representative Gardner do that. All right, that completes our agenda for today, and we are adjourned.
Yeah.
We pulled it from the schedule today.
Mr. Gardner.